Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 10 years ago tomorrow, Mark Zuckerberg and his roommates launched a website called The Facebook from their dorms at Harvard University. Originally designed exclusively for Harvard students, the social network quickly expanded to envelop other Ivy League schools and eventually the rest of the world. Now an estimated 1 out of every 12 people on the planet has a Facebook profile. So today, Word of Mouth is exploring the powerful influence that Facebook has had on our public and private lives, as well as the way businesses operate online and its many other impacts on our society and our culture. Joining me is NHPR's host of All Things Considered and our web culture analyst, Brady Carlson.
Hi there.
And also Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby, who went out and interviewed a number of Granite Staters for this segment. Taylor, great to have you on this side of the aisle again.
Thanks for having me.
So 10 years, is that a long time? Is that not a long time? A very short one.
Well, in web terms, it's an eternity. You think of the 10 years that took place before Facebook came along. What were the big websites at the time? Well, it's hard to even say because there wasn't a graphical browser interface like Firefox or Internet Explorer at that time. So the conception of what a top site means is completely different. And to think of what the web is going to look like in 10 more years is hard to even fathom at this point.
You know, and just to add to that, I think when it comes to these big anniversaries, you know, people tend to think of them as hearkening back to this big collective moment where, you know, everybody sort of experienced the same thing at the same time. But that's not the case with Facebook, because even though it's been around for 10 years, there were very few people that were using it at the very beginning. And, you know, really a lot of especially older users, I think, have probably only been on Facebook for 2 or 3 or maybe 4 years. So I think the idea that, you know, this 10-year anniversary of Facebook is a really sort of amazing moment as a culture and as society is true. That being said, it's maybe only been a couple of years that it's been changing the individual lives of a lot of the people who have been actually using it.
Right. It's a trickle-on kind of thing. I was trying to remember why I first joined Facebook. Do you either of you remember?
I do. And in fact, I remember the date. I looked it up. March 19th, 2005. A friend of my wife's at UNH suggested that all of us get onto Facebook because we were looking for a place to be that wasn't MySpace, which the garish colors and the kind of creepy icons that were dancing and all of that. And that was sort of the first big innovation that Facebook had. It sort of cleaned up that social platform that we all sort of were gravitating to. People who were online a lot were looking for a place like that, but we just didn't want it to be MySpace.
For me, it was professional reasons. I started working at New Hampshire Public Radio at Word of Mouth, and I'd use Facebook a little bit to research sources or something like that when I was a radio producer doing news. But it was, you're supposed to be on Facebook. So I was a little kicking and screaming. How about you, Taylor?
Yeah, Virginia, I had a very similar experience. I held out for a long, long time. You know, I had a MySpace account. And then when that fell to the wayside, I think I was exasperated and didn't feel like sort of rebuilding my digital persona or something. But either way, I didn't join until I think March of 2010. And this was just a couple months before I graduated college. So I had spent the previous 4 years, you know, talking to people, and they would be aghast when they discovered that I didn't have a Facebook. When I did join, it was a choice that I made because I knew I was going to be graduating in a couple months. And if I wanted to stay connected with a lot of the people that I met in school or before that, I would have to meet them where they were. And that was on Facebook.
And that's a very concrete example of how Facebook and companion sites have changed the game when it comes to social networking. 10 years ago, before there was a Facebook, people would have found ways to connect with each other, but it would have been more like collecting each other's email addresses. Mm-hmm. But the idea that there would be one central place online where everyone would be is a big change from how we have interacted online up to that point.
It takes a lot less effort that way as well. You know, you can see people are presenting rather than you seeking out. But let's remember that as ubiquitous as Facebook is, there are plenty of people who have chosen not to have a profile. We spoke to a few of them for this segment to find out why.
I do a lot more productive things when I'm not on Facebook, so I read more books. I am more interactive with my family, so those are my reasons.
I feel it's very invasive in many ways in life. I've seen friends and family have serious issues with a lot of intrusion into privacy, and I don't have the time for it either.
I think it's also the lack of control over what's happening with your presence or your the likeness of you, in the sense that once somebody has a picture, it becomes out of your realm to say, no, I really don't want that posted. So there's really nothing that says, do you want it posted or not? And that would be a concern to me. That's one of my big ones. If I had a grandchild, I might change my mind, however, but I don't at this point.
Big thing mentioned there, the privacy issue, which has recurred. And Brady, you and I have talked over it many, many times. You've been following concerns over Facebook's privacy policies longer than the rest of us. So how do you think it fits into the 10-year legacy thus far? And where is it going to come up in the future?
Well, it's a huge part, first of all, of the legacy of Facebook and social networking in general. These are not simply just centralized social networks. They're really centralized data networks in a way, and we're all contributing to them, at least all of us who are on them. And that's hugely useful for anyone who wants to know what we do. And that could be advertisers and marketers. Facebook advertising is incredibly detailed to an unparalleled degree of how you can target people that you want to send your message to. But that could also include law enforcement or surveillance agencies. It could mean credit rating agencies. Potential employers, and so much more. There are big pros and cons that come with that. The Facebook piece of that legacy is a sort of long-term push for more sharing and more disclosure, to the point that Facebook is essentially, for some people, a life log. It's really not only what they're doing, who they're doing it with, where they're doing it, what time they're doing it, and I would say, as a whole, we are more comfortable now as a group than we were 10 years ago with posting that level of information and to that level of detail. Some people like to overshare. In fact, Facebook encourages oversharing. There's actually research that shows that in some people, Facebook encourages a sort of narcissism. So privacy is it's a serious issue, but it's an issue with more facets than we typically discuss.
That's Brady Carlson. He's NHPR's All Things Considered host and also a benchmark, a touchstone for us when we talk about things on the web. And Taylor Quimby, word of mouth producer, is also with us. And we're talking about the 10th anniversary of Facebook. Both of you touched on something that is a big criticism of Facebook as well. You know, the idea that we care more about the newsfeed changing than about the deeper thing of privacy, that Facebook is in itself made for the surface. A lot of people ask about whether Facebook has changed the nature of friendship. And it has introduced this whole, to me, aspect of friend V. You know, like the people who are your close friends, you still have real communion with in some way. But the people who are likely to just kind of try and show themselves off all the time are using that opportunity to show themselves off. So has it changed the way you look at people in your community?
I think what it's done for sure is it's overemphasized the public selves of each of the people that are in my broader network. The physical counterpart that I use to describe the relationships we have on Facebook is sort of like our party selves. When we go out to somebody's party, it's not that we're being inauthentic, but it's a certain facet of ourselves that we display. The selves that we display when we're in a group, when we're amongst people, we're telling stories, we're telling jokes, we're interacting on a level that's not necessarily with our deepest companions. And that's more or less the way that we act on Facebook.
Well, is Facebook still cool? Are people still joining and asking you to friend them?
Well, yes, largely, at least for the time being.
If you're not a teenager.
If you're not a teenager, I mean, that's the big sort of pop culture fascination right now. Are the kids of today leaving Facebook? I mean, there's some research that suggests they might be. Given that we started out with more or less a big monolith of social media, there's going to be some fragmentation as new platforms come out. So people are going to go where they feel most useful. But, I mean, it's also worth pointing out that this isn't like car buying. It's not buying a Chevy or buying a Ford. If you're on Facebook, you can also be on Snapchat. But it's also a platform beyond social networking. And that's another piece that Facebook has been extremely good at over the last 10 years that doesn't always get a lot of attention. I mean, we could just as easily call Facebook a gaming platform as we could a social network. Because a huge amount of Facebook traffic comes from Farmville or any of these other games that people play.
Still?
Maybe not Farmville today, but you get the idea. I mean, we could call it Facebook as a music platform because of the partnership with Spotify. We could talk about it as a photo platform because it bought Instagram. Most recently, Facebook has become an identity platform. If you sign up for a number of new websites, whether they're social networks or applications, you don't set up a username and password like you used to. You just click in with your Facebook credentials, and that's your identity. So even if it's not cool for a 15-year-old to hang out on Facebook and do chatting there, it may be useful for 35, 40, or 50-year-olds to log into their bank accounts or their news readers.
Yeah, I mean, I think Facebook doesn't really need to be cool. You know, I think when it comes to, you know, sort of the death of Facebook, which has definitely been, I think, sort of greatly exaggerated. You know, there's this one study that's getting passed around right now. And I should say that it's not peer reviewed as of yet, but it sort of compares Facebook to diseases. It's an epidemiological look at social media. And it says that Facebook is likely to see a massive, massive decline in usership between, I think, 2015 and 17. Well, diseases that mutate are the most infectious diseases. Facebook, in some ways, is something that has learned how to mutate. You know, if Facebook was static and never changed, would we see massive decline in people using it in the next couple of years? Definitely. But is Facebook today going to be the same Facebook of 2 years from now? Most definitely not.
Well, even in the age of Facebook, we are having a face-to-face conversation here, a roundtable with Brady Carlson and Taylor Quimby on the occasion of the 10th anniversary of Facebook. In a moment, we're going to return and look at the future of Facebook, both as a social network and as a publicly traded company. Stay with us for more. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
A year and a half ago, I made the decision to get off of Facebook. I was like, you know what? I don't need this spy company in my life. I'm leaving, and the rest of America is gonna follow me, too. What you don't realize is that people just, if you leave Facebook, people just immediately assume, oh, I guess he's dead or moved to England or something.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today we're talking about, what else? Facebook.
People want to go on the internet and check out their friends, so why not build a website that offers that? Friends, pictures, profiles, whatever you can visit, browse around. Maybe it's someone you just met at a party. But I'm not talking about a dating site. I'm talking about taking the entire social experience of college and putting it online.
Tomorrow marks 10 years since Zuckerberg's baby was founded in the dormitories of Harvard University. It's a great time to explore how Facebook has influenced our public and our private lives and our businesses, our online experience, and really our experience of the world at large since so many people use it. We've already done some looking back, so let's pivot forward to the future. Before I reintroduce our guest today, here is what you had to say about whether Facebook will still be around 10 years from now.
I feel like it would take a lot to get people to leave Facebook and go to something else. In all honesty, I don't know what would be next or what directions they could possibly move. I think they have covered a lot of ground. So.
No, I feel like it's a fad and it's like going to wear away just like MySpace did. So.
Oh, poor Mark Zuckerberg.
He's rich enough, it's okay.
Yeah. Can't even speculate right now. I mean, huge changes. As we know it now, it'll in 10 years, we won't even recognize it, I think.
Will they continue? I think the only way it'll actually fail is if they don't grow as a business, because they have to, now that they're a publicly traded company, they have to make money.
Yeah, I think they've done a lot to make their app very sticky, and there's a lot of inertia to it. So, you know, you don't want to pull your pictures out and put them into something else. And so I think that they're probably here to stay.
Joining me in the studio is Word of Mouth's Taylor Quimby and our web culture analyst, Brady Carlson. Quite a few mixed opinions there. What do you think, Taylor? What's your come-away impression?
You know, it's not surprising that there are mixed opinions. I think there was one person that I spoke to. You heard her. She said that it's just a fad. You know, she's 17. This is exactly what a lot of people have been saying. Young people are not interested in Facebook, but she has a profile. She uses it. She probably uses it differently than the rest of us do, but she uses it nonetheless. Some of those other people, you know, also not willing to speculate because they think the same thing that I do. We just can't say what Facebook is going to look like in a few years.
And we have seen that looking through the 10-year history of Facebook. And remember when the site first started out, there was no like button. There was sharing photos was much more difficult. They were a lot smaller. They weren't as prominent a prominent piece of that.
And no timeline.
There were no pages for musicians or politicians or news organizations. And that's just the social network component of the experience. Now we're starting to get into a situation where we're talking about the experience of the entire site itself. Facebook is about to launch application called Paper, which takes the information on the site out of the vertical river of posts and links and videos and turns it into something where you can spend more time with each individual post. They call them stories, as paper stories. So that idea that we might have a very different looking Facebook in 2 or 3 years is very likely.
Paper is launching today, so everybody can have their own experience taking a look at it. Well, I've been reading an awful lot about people who have left Facebook. There are numerous postings about how it's changed people's lives. And there seems to be a couple of three different tracks here. One is they have a clearer mind, more time. You know, they're not wasting as much time. Another, realizing who their real friends are. And I think another one would be feeling like they're less on display and getting less criticism, feeling less agitated by, you know, the outside world kind of coming to them. Now, we may not be typical Facebook users. We're sort of representing a generational spread here. But how much room do people have for social networks in their lives? Is that going to continue?
It's very likely to continue, given that the research seems to show that younger people, this is a sort of fundamental piece of how they communicate with each other and present themselves to the world. But the idea of that social anxiety about posting and checking, I mean, that's something that you do see from people who say maybe their cell phone is in a dead zone and they can't access that stream. You see people who are standing outside of a building nervously checking their messages, their texts, or their Facebook or their Twitter profiles just to see what goes on. And that's something that I think is probably still to be reckoned with a little bit. What is the term they call it? Fear of missing out? FOMA? Mm-hmm. FOMO? Yeah. I'm not sure exactly what the resolution is for that. And I'm not sure necessarily that people who are off of Facebook are immune from that either. As I have advice to a number of people, the fact that you do not have a profile on Facebook does not mean you're necessarily off of Facebook.
Yeah. You know, I think that's a really interesting point, and it speaks to one of the reasons that I got on in the first place. Basically, at some point, I was over the shoulder of a friend who was on Facebook, and I saw a picture of myself on his profile. You know, he had uploaded pictures from, I think it was a wedding, and, you know, there I am sort of dancing in the background like a crazy man. And I think that's a big part of the Facebook experience, like we've talked about, is you get to sort of shape who you are, regardless of whether or not that's an authentic version of yourself. But if you're not there to decide what pictures go up and what you say and what you do, then somebody else is going to provide that profile for you. When it comes to sort of the number of social media outlets that people can use, I think there's definitely a limit. For some people, that limit is much higher than others. You know, I know people who are really savvy with social media tend to use the sort of aggregators like, what's it called?
Hootsuite.
That's the one that I know every day I'm like, oh, I should totally do Hootsuite. But I don't. And so that's going to limit the number of platforms that I can use. But Brady over here, he's a savvy guy, so he's probably got double the amount that I do.
Well, I have to use the aggregators because I can't possibly keep up with them. I'm not savvy enough, actually. But that just shows you how the technology is trying to evolve to meet those needs for people who are feeling like they're drowning in too many platforms and too many social networks.
You mentioned at the jump that 10 years is an eternity online. Anybody really expect 10 more years from Facebook?
You've got to think about it this way. So Coke and Diet Coke are both the two most popular soft drinks. Pepsi has sort of moved back, but Pepsi makes more money because Pepsi owns more soda brands and a diverse number of other things. So Facebook doesn't need to be the coolest or hippest thing to still be around in 10 years. It needs to own the coolest and hippest thing. Remember, they already own Instagram. You know, we often hear about how Snapchat is the thing that young people are going to use instead of Facebook.
Right.
Well, what if in 5 years Facebook owns Snapchat?
Well, it sort of already owns all of our photographs, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Your question was, does anybody think that Facebook will be around in 10 years? Well, Mark Zuckerberg certainly does. And one of the things that he has shown is he has a knack for finding a new place for the site to go and to develop and to evolve. That's not to say that it's a sure thing. The web is a very finicky place, as anyone who has ever gone to Yahoo can say. I mean, that was a huge thing. And all of a sudden came along Google, which was better at what Yahoo did than Yahoo was.
You know, I just want to jump in, not to get the last word or anything, but if in 10 years Facebook was gone and there was some sort of, you know, epic fall, there would be definitely another movie in the works for David Fincher.
In a way, you would almost have to work it, though, so that there was a trilogy. There would have to be a second movie premonishing that there would be a fall, and then the third movie is the fall.
Right, right.
Okay, well, so I'll see you guys in Hollywood, and I'll see you on Facebook.
Thanks, Virginia.
Thank you.
Brady Carlson there, NHPR's host of All Things Considered and Word of Mouth culture analyst, and Word of Mouth producer Taylor Quimby. Special thanks to Gibson's Bookstore and to True Brew Cafe for letting Taylor interrupt customers for this segment. You can learn more about Paper, Facebook's new mobile app, and see an infographic detailing 10 years of Facebook. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. We'd like to know how Facebook has changed your life. Are you happy to be connected with old friends from middle school, former flames, or distant cousins? Do you use it to keep up on news or events, or is it just a time suck? Have you considered leaving the social network? You can join our conversation, taking place where else but on our Facebook page, facebook.com/word of mouth.
Looking at pictures on Facebook of your ex-girlfriend at 3 in the morning. Never helped anyone, never helped anyone, never helped. Getting so drunk, you fall over.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
Okay, so we talked about how Facebook has influenced how we and many other Americans communicate. But Facebook is a global phenomenon. We learned a lot about that when it was used as a tool for protesters during the Iranian elections of 2009 and in the early days of the Arab Spring. Of the 1.2 billion Facebook users worldwide, 93 million are in India. Elliot Hannon of World Vision Report brings us this story from New Delhi, where the social network is being used to enforce traffic laws.
Satyendra Garg doesn't look like your average Facebook junkie. In India, Facebook is still largely for the young and tech-savvy, not graying government employees. Garg, however, sits behind his desk at the New Delhi police headquarters, commenting on posts and responding to friend requests. Until recently, he had never even tried Facebook. But when he took over the Delhi traffic police earlier this year, he faced a stark reality.
In Delhi, like, we have about 6.5 million vehicles on the roads. And maybe like 2 million coming to Delhi every day from nearby towns. And this is a terrible number.
With only several thousand officers to patrol the roads every day, and without traffic cameras to catch drivers speeding and running red lights, he was overmatched. So he turned to Facebook for help in taming the city's congestion problems.
Basically, the idea behind Facebook was that it's a two-way interaction. Like, we wanted to interact with the road users from our side. But at the same time, we wanted honest feedback from people, the road users, like what difficulties they face.
So a few months ago, the Delhi Traffic Police started a Facebook page. Since then, its membership has grown to more than 25,000 drivers, like Karen Agarwal. Agarwal's daily commute is only about 8 miles, but it can take up to an hour. He posts regularly on the page about the problems he sees. I joined him for his morning commute.
Like, getting out of your house is like getting stuck in a jam. People are not following traffic rules. We want that people should follow traffic rules. Like, see, this, he's also, someone will hit him. Who will be responsible tomorrow?
Agarwal points out the violations as he maneuvers through a swirl of cars veering in every direction. The problem, he says, is that traffic tickets are given so rarely that they're not much of a deterrent.
No one has got the fear in their mind. We need to get the fear thing in their mind.
To help with that fear thing, the Delhi traffic page allows anyone to upload photos of offenders caught in the act. Most of the photos are taken with cell phones. If there's enough evidence, police will issue a ticket. Already 6,000 pictures have been uploaded, and over 1,000 tickets issued thanks to Facebook informants. At the traffic headquarters, walkie-talkies squawk as officers call in violations from the road. T. Yashwan, a traffic inspector, says the surge in photos has led to the creation of a brand new department.
We have a 4 shifts. One person sit on this Facebook, so we work round the clock, 24/7.
He peers over the shoulder of a young officer clicking through Facebook photos of buses parked on the sidewalk, taxis running red lights, and drivers caught weaving in and out of traffic. Rakesh Arora is the owner of a security company in Delhi. Speaking from his car, he says he's uploaded a dozen photos he's taken during his commute.
I can't leave my own business or I can't leave my own job and be on the road to take the pictures of all the violators. But what I'm doing is I'm assisting Delhi Traffic Police by clicking some of the photographs.
And what about people out to settle a score by getting someone in trouble? So far, there hasn't been a single complaint, says Traffic Commissioner Satyendra Garg. Garg says that the threat of criminal charges for those out for revenge and pictures that are doctored has been a good deterrent. During his morning commute, Karen Agarwal says he contributes to the site by notifying the police of problems like broken traffic lights, but he doesn't like the idea of nabbing fellow drivers. That, he says, is what the traffic cops are for.
It's their duty to look at it. Why they want us to do their work? I'm not authorized to click anyone's picture.
Tara Singh leans on his dented black taxi in South Delhi. He's driven a cab here for 12 years. His home is in northern India, and he spends the night under a plastic tarped roof with other drivers at the cab stand. Singh says even though he doesn't know much about Delhi's new online traffic cops, he thinks it's worth a try.
I'm not entirely sure whether it will help. As for me, I'm a pretty good driver. I've gotten a ticket only once in my life. If I made a mistake, I wouldn't mind if someone caught me, if it will make the roads better.
In his office, Satyendra Garg browses his department's Facebook page, responding to questions and concerns.
All this is in less than 24 hours. I mean, maybe 1,000 posts.
1,000 posts in 24 hours, he says. Garg thinks enlisting drivers to post pictures has been a positive step. His only word of caution is that photos shouldn't be taken while driving. That, he says, is also a ticketable offense. For the World Vision Report, this is Elliot Hannon in New Delhi.
With us for a really intimate look into race, class, and the black male achievement gap in education. We're going to be speaking to one of the filmmakers and a parent behind the documentary American Promise. It airs tonight on POV. That conversation, when word of mouth continues, after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's the American dream. Give your children a better life than you had. That's what the respective parents of two African-American boys were hoping for when they sent their kids to Dalton, a prestigious, predominantly white school on Manhattan's Upper East Side. Filmmakers Michelle Stevenson and Joe Brewster decided to document the education of their five-year-old son, Idris Brewster, along with that of a neighbor, Cheyenne Summers. They expected great things, namely that a school of that caliber would open doors for the rest of the boys' lives. Here's the adolescent Idris wondering what it would take to get through those doors.
But if I was white, then I'd be better off. Isn't that true?
You asking me?
Yes.
What do you think?
Yes. Well, at this school, I'm not saying I want to, but wouldn't that be, isn't that right?
After recording Idris and Cheyenne for more than 13 years, Michelle Stevenson and Joe Brewster directed and produced an intimate exploration of race and class and the black male achievement gap in the documentary film American Promise. The film makes its broadcast premiere on PBS's POV series tonight. And Michelle Stevenson is with us from New York. Michelle, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
I read that when you and your husband began this film, you were following several of the diverse students at Dalton, girls as well as boys. When and why did you decide to make Idris and Cheyenne the focus?
we started the project as part of this exploration of this diversity initiative that the school was embarking on, the Dalton School, and that we as a family in Idris were a part of. And it was really started off as a 13-year longitudinal piece that would be this mosaic of a variety of different experiences and from different students in the classroom. As the years went on, the girls who were part of the project ended up dropping out of the project because I think the commitment, that 13-year commitment, was just too long. Hmm. But that ended up actually being a blessing in disguise for us because as middle school started, the girls had all left the project, still at the school. We found ourselves in the midst of really experiencing issues that were particular to our African-American boys and their relationship to education. And so we decided to keep the camera rolling and continued to explore this journey.
Things did get pretty intense in the middle school years, but even before that, there were few kids at Dalton, few people who looked like these two boys. Soon they began to recognize their difference. Cheyenne brushes his gums to the point of bleeding to make them appear less brown and more pink, like the kids at school. And when did you first begin to hear the awareness of difference in your son, Idris?
Oh, my gosh. From kindergarten, we were starting to hear these questions. And our son one day came home talking about, you know, they keep asking me, am I rich, am I poor? And I keep saying I'm in the middle, but they keep asking me, am I rich, am I poor? Kind of wanting to put him in a box. And so these things around racial perception and identity come from a very, very young age.
Right. I can see you questioning in the film the perception, you know, your kids are more likely to get punished at school. But there's also this punishing schedule and expectations at home. And from what Idris says, punishment in the neighborhood for talking white, as he does when playing ball at the Queensbridge Housing Projects. Here he is. I think he's 9 or 11 in this scene.
Sometimes, like, change my voice. I go, like, hey, y'all, what's up? Or I change my voice. I don't talk like I talk at Dalton so they won't make fun of me. I talk slangish or something.
Turn around!
I've been lying to my parents and saying, oh, I don't notice that I'm changing my voice. Because I don't want them, like, they're going to think that I'm, like, a coward or something.
That's a scene from the film American Promise. I'm speaking with one of the filmmakers, Michelle Stevenson, who's also the mother of that young boy, who we see it turns adorable and sullen and vulnerable as he grows up. And seeing you as these loving parents witnessing his frustration, I'm wondering about that experience for you. We learn an awful lot about your families of origin in the film and the pressure that you feel like you and your husband are putting on your son. I wonder, watching the film yourself, do you look at that and say, oh my God, what was I thinking? What was I doing?
You know, of course there are painful moments. You know, parenting doesn't come with a guidebook, right?
Right.
It's something that you sort of learn along the way. And in addition to that, though, I think it is important for us to understand the context in which our boys are perceived. If anything, you know, low expectations are the norm, whether it's at Dalton or the public high school down the street.
We see these low expectations kind of borne out over and over in the film. Idris has trouble focusing at school. Cheyenne does as well. And things do get more difficult as they're heading into middle school, where both of them are put into a tutoring program. We can clearly see that all the kids in the program are black. So there's the perception in the school of their difference. But I found myself also wondering how white children fared in the school. What do you know about that, having followed your kids so closely?
For the most part, I learned a lot of it, you know, through Idris, essentially. We had certain parents that we were also connected with, but I learned a lot about the dynamics through his conversations. And I think what's interesting about that question of tutoring, there are two things. One, you know, the administration and had the children's best intentions in mind. They talked about needing to make it a level playing field. However, what ended up happening is the boys that were being labeled in terms of being, you know, sticking out. So there's a self-perpetuating cycle of how they're perceived and then how they internalize that perception. But what we do understand is Dalton itself is really a microcosm of the larger society. Mm. There isn't really that much difference. We experience these biases no matter where the school or what type of school it is. It's really about how do we address the experience and how do we turn it around to make it more constructive, and also how open are administrators to engaging in the conversation when these experiences happen.
But there are alternatives. The principal at Benjamin Banneker Academy in Brooklyn, this is the high school where Cheyenne actually ends up after leaving Dalton, is creating sort of an alternative safe space for the kids. Let's hear from him.
When the school first started, the idea was the school would be in a community that was African American and Latino. A third to a half of the kids come from the Fort Greene Projects right here. We modeled it almost after those early segregated schools in the South, and it became a nurturing place. We want kids to be successful, do some challenging work, but made to feel good about themselves and not always worrying about how they're going to fit in or how people are going to look at them. I'm not against, you know, kids being in diverse environments. But at this point, over my many years of being in this system, it's not really necessary. White people never talk about that. They never say, I want to go to take my kid out of this all-white school and put him in a black school so things will be more diverse. It just, people don't think that way, and I don't know why we have to think that way. 3 out of 5. Because we can teach our kids.
That's a clip from the principal at Benjamin Banneker Academy in Brooklyn from the film American Promise. Dalton did make an effort to diversify its population, but initially we see all white teachers until middle school when there is a black male advisor and high school English teacher. Do you think Dalton really thought through what it meant to educate a diverse population?
I think Dalton, along the years, as they engaged in this diversity initiative, came to realize that diversity is not enough. Increasing the numbers are just one step along the process, and it requires a number of different things. One, and some of these things that it requires have to do with being able to have conversations around race, whether it's the teachers acknowledging their own assumptions that come into the dynamics of the classroom and how they perceive our boys or the girls of color, and also parents being able to get together and talk to each other about their experiences and also sharing information about what makes, you know, better solutions around, you know, homework style or even addressing questions of stereotype. And those are essential ingredients to be able to have a more successful, diverse environment. Another crucial thing that I think is important is to, once we engage in this type of endeavor that we really believe in as a mission, it is important to understand that the entire community must buy into it.
There were times when I wanted to just cry for both of these kids, for their own disappointments and some family tragedies in the case of Cheyenne. And you present pretty unflinchingly how invested you as parents are in his success. And what I'm hearing from you now is a look or a reflection of a need for a holistic approach by institutional, by parental, by familial. Looking at this now, how do you think Idris is reflecting on his own role inside of this educational experiment, which was originally meant to be called the Dalton Experiment?
I think that for Idris, what I do know is not only is he prepared academically to really flourish, but social and emotionally, these experiences he has gone through and has been able to process, and that we have helped him process along the way, gives him makes him well-equipped in the future. And I think it may be a little too early to tell, you know, what the total ramifications are, because they are still growing, you know, and some of this experience is still being absorbed, especially as his world widens in the college environment. I have full faith in Idris's sense of self and ability to kind of engage in the world in a constructive way. For me, one of the highlights, painful but also important highlights one of the scenes that we depict is really around this college application process, mm-hmm. and I don't want to reveal it all completely,
right.
but I felt very proud in my son's ability to articulate and push back against us in a discussion that ultimately, you know, his point of view was accepted, and he was able to make the trail for his future destiny.
Well, Michelle Stevenson, thank you very much for joining us and congratulations on the film.
Thank you very much. It was really a pleasure to talk with you.
American Promise premieres tonight at 10 on PBS's POV series. You can watch a trailer and find more on local listings on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The environment a child grows up in has a monumental impact on their education. For teenagers like Tierra Jackson, with no family support, getting an education becomes secondary to surviving. She enrolled in a charter school where John Horan was dean. They sat down together for StoryCorps to talk about what Tierra's life was like when they first met.
My mother wasn't really around when my brother and I were young. She was in prison a lot, so I was with my aunt and her kids and my brother, about seven of us. We shared a room in one of the city's homeless shelters. As if high school is not hard enough itself. You know, the hour and a half bus ride, it was kind of exhausting.
And most people didn't know this. And we kept yelling at you for being late.
I was embarrassed. I was 14 and I was homeless. I didn't want people to look at me like, oh, you know, she needs charity. We have to take care of her. But there are things that I needed for my classes. And I was just like, we don't have money for this stuff. I went to my aunt, and I remember she sent me to school with notes that explained the situation. I think the first teacher I gave the note to came to school with this bag of things for me, and I didn't know how to accept it. But after that, she never treated me differently, and I think that's one of the things I appreciated. I knew that I'm intelligent, you know. I have a brain with thoughts that matter.
You're working your way through college with the extra burden of caring for your brother and caring for your mom.
I work part-time for a financial management company. I go to school and I help my brother with his homework. I try to do my homework. I don't really go out much, you know. I was so tired today. I stayed up all night studying. I wanted to go to bed so bad, but I can't because I have to get A's. I have to do well in school. It's the only thing that I have that can get me out. There are so many people who could, you know, be the next Bill Gates and change the world. But because they're poor or they're living in poverty, they're instantly written off because no one thinks they'll make it. I just want to make it.
That's Tierra Jackson with John Horan at StoryCorps in Chicago. Thank you for spending some time with us today. It is hard to believe, but tomorrow does mark the 10th anniversary of Facebook. I was reminded yesterday of how the social network functions in my life after hearing the news that actor Philip Seymour Hoffman was found dead of a possible drug overdose. I posted an article and watched as others did the same. Now, I don't follow a lot of celebrity news, but my Facebook news feed yesterday became a place to watch people who shared my sadness as they weighed in with their shock and grief about the seemingly lonely death of a truly brilliant actor. That's one of the ways that Facebook has changed things for me. It has become a kind of virtual town square or maybe dinner table or a comfy couch where people can come together, even when we are very, very far apart. Whether taking place in real-time mourning, or that gripping minute-by-minute hunt for Zohar Tsarnaev, or the more trivial response to Bob Dylan making car commercials, Facebook allows us to be part of a conversation with many people at once. And it's a conversation I might have not been having otherwise. The value of that conversation is the real question. Has the social network changed us for better or for worse? Has the space for sharing the good news of the birth of a child or a wedding announcement or buying a house made you feel closer to others or detached from those who live in your real world? Has it encouraged us to overshare? Tell us what you think. Tell us how Facebook has changed your life. Where else but on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth, the program, will be back tomorrow at 2 with more surprising stories and ideas right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.